Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I'm your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have Miss Annie Green with me here today. Annie, how are you?
I am fine.
Oh,
Looking
I'm so
forward to our
glad to hear.
conversation.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much for joining. For those of the folks out here, listeners that don't have the opportunity to know you yet, do you mind just telling everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
I have been in this field for quite some time. I actually have a doctorate from George Washington University, which was one of the first knowledge management, so to speak, programs that was brought to the United States by Dr. Michael Stankowski. When I finished, my area that I looked focused on was intangible asset valuation, and that is valuing knowledge within an organization. And the driver behind that was that we had a complete accounting system that could tell us the tangible value that we had, but there was nothing to say what was the value of brands and different things that were coming in that were bringing in additional money, and also the ex expertise of people. So with that, I wanted to see about setting up a system that would allow us to do that so that it wouldn't just be so uneven that when we looked at an organization, we only looked at tangible and we didn't look at the intangible values that were coming in. Well, to make a long story short, along that path, I've stood up knowledge management programs. I have, when I got my master's, I actually, that's what I ventured into artificial intelligence. I have that worked in public and private sector and in education. I teach at several universities. I have taught at George Washington, at Georgetown, at George Mason, at Kent State, and also at Maryland University. So I've been in this field for a while. And right now I'm writing books. This is my first book that came out that I expect to cross over, that I hope that it will grab the attention of the layperson so that they can begin to understand AI as well. Let me see, what else can I say about me? I'm a learner, and so I keep digging in so that I can start sharing what I have learned, the things that I have practiced, and how I think that AI can actually help us. And I want to back up and say that I am a strong advocate of technology. I believe technology is definitely our savior. My thing is the proper use of it and it being used purposeful. So that's one of the directions that I like to drive as well, that we think about what we're putting in place. And when I look at things like AI, I always say, well, let's look at what's automated and then let's look at what's augmented. And that way it would give people a better view into how they fit in to this digital era. I hope that kind of strikes a little bit, but I have quite a bit of background in knowledge management, digital transformation, data management, data governance, and artificial intelligence. So I kind of bring the whole spectrum or the big picture of what we need in order to be successful in a digital era.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on the book for everybody. You mind telling everybody the title of the book and how they could find it?
Absolutely. The title of the book is A Diary of HI and AI, The Nexus of Human Intelligence and Artificial Intelligence. And right now it is available on Amazon. So it's under my name, Dr. Annie Green. And the title again is Diary of HI and AI, The Nexus of Human Intelligence and Artificial Intelligence. I think you'll really enjoy the read. Don't be fearful of it and think that it's so technical or scientific. It actually has some good twists in it that I think you will enjoy.
Absolutely. No, I love it. I've checked it out. It's an amazing read. I haven't read all of it yet. I perused it as we were saying before we started. But I wanna sit down and dig into it a little bit more. And today, as we're talking about, AI and the truth and how they relate to each other, before we get into all of that, can you talk a little bit about the fundamental difference between data management and data governance?
Yes.
And why neglecting data management is a failure.
Oh, absolutely. The key here is that in order for us to be to have a good foundation and future in the data digital era is that we have to have good data. Data is the bloodline. That is the source of what we're pulling because that's what represents us in the digital world. So data management is actually how do you extract, build, and actually create the data structures that we are going to be pulling information from. So that is actually, if you understand it, a framework, the methodology, the process, the procedures, the tools, everything that's needed in a system that needs to be managed or data management in order for us to have good data. Now, data governance, which is what you hear all the time and everybody putting into place, data governance is exactly what it says. It's governing. How do you know what you're governing if you don't have a framework to manage it under? So if you're not, if you, how can you meet compliance if you have not said how your naming conventions are supposed to be, how your structure is supposed to be, what data is in which tables, what data is within which systems, who has access to those systems, all of that information, because even when you get into privacy concerns and stuff, if you don't have all of that laid out such that when you get to governance, you can actually see that you're compliant with those rules and the way that it should be executing, then right then and there, you've kind of negated the fact that you need a source of truth in order to have good data flowing through your system.
It's fantastic. What are some of the real world consequences you've seen of not getting this right?
Oh, let me see if I could think of, let's see something.
Something not classified or under
Yeah,
NDA.
something that was in a paper, perhaps. Let's look at Washington, D.C., where I'm at, and this was in the paper. Washington, D.C. realized that they had not captured tax information, which is regulated, for 30 years on people. And when
Wow.
these people came to retire, what do you think happened?
Well, they didn't have anything to retire them on.
Right, but who's that? Who's responsible for that? Because the person knew it wasn't coming out of their check, but the organization should have ensured that it was coming out of their check.
Right. Is that the company's fault? Is that the government's fault? Like,
I
how
would say it was a government agency. I would say that our state and I would say that it's the company or the organization's fault. It's their responsibility to take it out.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
But
That's
that's
wild.
what could happen if you don't have those frameworks and those process and procedures in place to know. Because how do you go 30 years when you've even done migrations on a system and you don't recognize in your data that you're not transferring for a certain segment of people their tax information?
That's insane. That's insane. Did all were all the were all those people just SOL, or did they get taken care
No,
of?
I, you know what? They followed up on it a little bit later and they were still investigating it. And my guess is that those people would be compensated for what happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, no, I really appreciate that. That's shocking, but also, I mean, I've done work with DC government, so it's not so shocking at the end of the day. I can say that 'cause I'm not doing work with them right now. But as you think about lacking standardized data formats and naming
Oh,
conventions,
okay.
right?
Yeah.
How does how you know how is that broken? Like, how does that change, like, the source of truth?
Well, because you don't know what's within the field. See, most of the time when you do naming conventions, the naming conventions should give rise to the context as well as to the content within the element or within the attribute. Okay. And so if you're not naming it properly, then you don't know what it is. The other thing is, if you misuse one, you don't have a field, so you decide to use another field, and that field actually represents certain other data. Then now again, you have misled the person who comes in next that might pull it from the wrong element. So the key is your structures should be such that you can actually navigate to the information you want, or you can search for the information you want. So if you are using a search field to find something and you're using terms, and you don't have the proper terms within that structure, then you're liable to get bad information. Okay. And the other part is that we have so many different, sometimes things are stored in more than one place. And I'll use something that people might be able to identify with, like a salary. Your salary for the source of truth should be in a record that says that this is our source of record. Okay. So therefore, that's where my salary should come from. Now, if someone else is writing a system and they pull that and they use it only once, and guess what? It never gets updated, even though you've been there for 5 years and received five increments, okay? If somebody came in and they pulled from that system where they saw it and they used it, then it would not be accurate because it would not represent your current salary. It would only represent 5 years previous.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So yeah, so it's not only having the record and the source of truth, but it's also needed, we should be tying wherever that information is pulled from. So that's
Which is
automatic,
lineage,
updating,
absolutely.
right?
So
Okay.
that's the data lineage. You should know the start of data, you should know where it moves, and then you should eventually know where it finally resides. And that's when you get into like the records management so that you can do retention of it or disposition of it where you get rid of it.
That's fantastic. Fascinating. Fascinating. And then I know when we were initially speaking, you were talking about how the digital realm must represent the physical, right? And where did we initially fail in uniquely identifying people to like enable or like a reliable digital self?
And this is my statement. I think we failed with Social Security. When a person is born into the world, they should be uniquely identified at that point. So that gives them a unique identifier for wherever they move through a system. But that unique identifier should be it should be sensitive data, and it should be only owned, so to speak, by the federal government. So once you go out into the world, like if I take a job, they should be able to have access to that because they're going to be given taxes to it, right? But it should not be used within their systems. They should have an identifier within their system that they can then track back to that, okay? And that should be in a place where nobody can get to it. This way, that unique identifier could always reach out to all the things of a person and be able to make a profile that's accurate. The key is that when they did that, a lot of companies began to use the Social Security number as their unique identifier, which caused a lot of problems. Even in Virginia, and again, this is known public information in Virginia, where they used it on the driver's license. And it caused many problems because that made your unique identifier visible to other people who could then steal identities.
That's crazy, right? And you generally, you got a driver's license and a social security number, you can get most things, right? Like
You
you
got it. Well, now they've changed it. So in Virginia, you have to have a driver's license number. But the whole thing is nobody thought about that and nobody governed it. So the governance should have been that, that should have been a highly sensitive information that should not have been shared outside of certain areas within an organization.
And I think that would also simplify things a lot, especially, we just did an episode, I want to say a couple months ago, around medical records and how decentralized they all are, right? Like you think about,
Absolutely.
all your doctor's offices have some copies of them, and then the insurance companies have some, but they're not sending everything to them because they only send in things to the insurance companies that they need to process your data. Like,
Absolutely.
how
And
many doctor's
that's why,
offices? Go
too,
ahead.
a lot of doctors were not uniquely identified. A lot of doctors were only given identifiers based on the health plans that they were within. So therefore, they could actually practice in one state, they could get malpractice in another state, but still practice in another state because they couldn't tie them together.
Absolutely. And I would assume, and I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume that therapist licenses are the same because they're state by state by state, and they also have different legal requirements for different licenses in every state. So people that have, I know Maryland pretty well from that perspective, but like there are people that have 25 years of experience working as a therapist in Pennsylvania and Delaware, but they are not allowed to do that same job in Maryland because they don't meet the
Right.
educational requirements, right?
Right.
Which is just wild to me. So and as we think about this infrastructure, right, and we think about it all holistically, right, do we need a new like standard training data? Do we need like a new standard for training data quality with AI systems overall?
I think we need to enforce the old one. We have, see, this is one of my issues with what we're doing too. We tend to not, we eliminate things before we actually know that the value of them. Quality has always been something that we should have in place. And even when you look at the Systems Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, they have the activities, the accountability, the configuration items, and all of that, which is a great system for developing. And part of it is quality. What are your quality items? And when you're doing quality on something and building it, as you're building it, you should have planned it, designed it, and along the way, you validate it. And then you verify at the end that it's done. Okay. That hasn't changed, and I don't think it will change. Now, within that structure, can we with AI find pieces that would allow us to automate it and then in places to augment it? So the fact that we have eliminated systems engineering and process engineering out of how we're doing things, I think that's why we've kind of gone awry. I think that we still need that. Even with an electrician, if they don't have a schematic to know what to do within a house, you're going to pay them three, four times as much, but someone who has a schematic can go to get the problem. And I think a lot of times what we decide is let's get rid of those pieces because they're not important to us. We just want to get to the bottom line and then we suffer the problem. So throughout history, we've always put 99% of our budget into maintenance. And we haven't really changed that.
Absolutely. What old standard do you think we should be really enforcing? Is it
I think at the beginning, you need to lay the framework for the system, and then you need to design it. So, plan what you're going to do, lay it out, okay? And then you build your checklists and your structures for care quality. And you have your independent area. Even in business 101, they taught you don't have the same person purchase the products and then do the inventory. It goes through a process. So the same thing with that. We need to think about it. And I know that there's scalability and stuff when things are small. You should know that we go from tiny to big. And when you're tiny, you don't go through every step, but you do have things that you have to actually do to ensure quality in the end. So we need to back up and re-put those things in place. Again, a validation verification process. Let's have the checklist. Let's have the foundation. The main thing that saves us, even with systems, is that there's a whole framework out there that have things that you can use, that have a methodology that you can follow. But most people, like with the PMP or the Project Management Institute, most people take it literally. So they will say, I have to do all of this. When they don't, they can tailor it within their organization to ensure that they get the outcome. But I find that not understanding that methodologies are, they're perfect. They have everything for everybody in it. They're generalized. And that you need to spend the time to generalize, I mean, to tailor it and then move it forward in your organization so that when someone needs to see a checklist, they have it and they can pull it and it, saves time. All of that was still AI and
Absolutely.
knowledge management, because knowledge management is what do you need to do your job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've seen it starting businesses from a, like you have to generate job descriptions, right? And operating procedures. No, first, God forbid somebody leaves or takes a new job or quits or something else tragic happens, right? You can go in and be like, what was this person doing? Oh, let's look at the document and see,
You
right?
got it.
Document it all. As opposed to just like being, and I what was it I remember I read this little book years ago called Built to Sell, right? Which is all about like taking a business and creating, turning it into something that you can sell, right? So documenting processes, documenting procedures, doing things really like doing specific pieces really, really well, and then focusing on what you're doing really, really well. And because if you try, I think you try to go sell a business, right? And I mean, I just went through this recently. Unless you're, if all of this operating procedures and everything are in, say, the owner's head, right? Like, what are you even selling?
Absolutely.
Right? A customer list?
Absolutely.
No, you go to sell a business, you need to have the operations in place, and you need to have it structured and organized in a way.
Absolutely.
That
And that's
allows
what we
somebody else to
need.
come in and plug and play.
And that's what we need with this digital era. We need that for knowledge management, and we need that for AI. And the thing is, we tend to separate those two, but they're not mutually exclusive. Intelligence and knowledge come together.
Absolutely. I would say they inform each other.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're not, that's not isolation. I don't, you know, intelligence to me
Nope.
is, in a hurt in a human being, it's how like it's like processing power, like how fast can you process things? And if you only
Right.
know, if you only know stupid things, then all you're doing is doing stupid things faster.
Absolutely. 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 And as you know, and we also know that given time, people become more experienced and people lead up to experts. And not everybody's going to be an expert, but you want to be able to identify those who are experts because they can do things three times faster. So if you want a project and you want to get it done much quicker, then you load it up with experts, okay? But if you're going to load it up with novices, then you have to look at it. They do one third of the time that it takes for an expert.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're also a quarter of the cost, but that's probably why all these consulting firms out here do that and have one expert for the project and a whole bunch of junior people after they win and just have their tiger team of experts that work from project
Absolutely.
to project, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
We know the
And
game.
that, is misleading again. That's why I said the morality of man. It's on the
Absolutely.
bottom line dollar and not on the efficiency. We're supposed to be doing effectiveness and efficiency. And we look at effectiveness as if we reach the goal of the amount that we want, okay? But we don't look at efficiency of whether it was done well.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you saw this report that was just in the news recently in Australia. Deloitte had a project in Australia, and they turned in like a 65 or 70 page report, and it was 100% AI generated, and they never reviewed it. And literally there's a whole scandal now around, like, they had to give a piece of the money back because, like, it went in and made up sources and made up, like, it fabricated a whole lot of information that went into this. Now, obviously, Deloitte should have read it, but who do you hold accountable for that? And how could we hold the people that create these systems accountable for the output? And should we?
Again, without the processes in place, and I think they should be held accountable. I think on that particular thing, both are at fault. Deloitte should have read it, and those who were delivering it should have made certain that it was of quality. And I've seen this before because sometimes they don't want to hear it. I went in, and this is, no names or anything, but I went in on a project and I noticed that in a report that was done, and it was a huge, pretty huge report. And most of the stuff in there, I saw it was cut and paste because I do a lot of research and I saw what was going on. And I actually wanted to make them this known in a proper way without actually, degrading someone or anything like that. But I wanted the company to know. And my hand was slapped. And it was told, don't do that. And so, that's what happened. And that report winded up never getting implemented.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And first grade didn't get implemented, but second, I'm not surprised. People were doing things the easy way. But as in and as we think about these the biased and unreliable outputs from these systems, which is a huge problem, right? And I think everybody knows that there's a large problem, and we call it hallucinations now, but I mean, that's really system failures, right? When you're going into a system and you're not getting what you want out of it, or it's lying to you, or it's not I'm telling you the objective truth, or that's a to me, that's a system failure. I think that hallucination is just like a rebranding of that. I'm not sure if you agree with that or not, but
It is, but it could be human error or it could be system error. Because a lot of times we change formats and raw data coming in has no structure. It doesn't have structure until you put it into the metadata that represents it. Okay. And what we need to realize is that if you change one byte on that thing, okay, then it could lead to hallucinations throughout a whole stream of data. So if we're not, again, checking behind ourselves to make certain that one, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, and then two, the technology is doing what we are telling it to do, then we're going to continue to get these hallucinations. But my thing is, I don't like that what they do is they put it on the system and they say, oh, the system developed its own language. The system didn't necessarily develop its own language. It's that it's trying to interpret what's being put forth in it, and what's being put forth in it is not correct in the metadata.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Out of curiosity, one thing I've been very curious about recently is, you look at the amount of plausible information that's being generated, AI generated, that's going out into the ecosystem, right? And because I don't care, what the information is on, right? You and I both know you go out and do a Google search about anything, two different sides of it, right? Like, you're gonna come up like, is drinking wine good for you, right? And you'll be able to find a report that says in moderation, yes, and another report that says in excess, yes, and another report that says never. And thinking that, like, as we think about the, that's just a pretty benign example, but as we start thinking about these things applied to, whether it's medical information, it's been happening for a long time, political information, that's been happening for a long time, and I think that it's been happening for a long time, largely human generated. And now I think that we're able to generate a lot more of it a lot faster with a lot less people involved. What does that do to the idea of like the objective truth? How is that eroding it? Is it eroding it?
Yeah, I think it has been eroded because you know what? One of the biggest things, and right now I'll say it's the influence of truth. Right now we pay people to influence how many people to believe what they're saying, regardless of if it's true or not. So we're in this big influencer society where even like with AI, one of the things that I notice that when people talk about AI, they talk about it as if it's a person. And even like the father who or the parents, I think of the young man who winded up killing himself, who asked, how can I kill myself? But then also, how can they find me right before this happens? Okay. And the fact that they are going to, somebody told me, they said, well, he's not going to sue AI, he's going to sue the company. And I looked at him and I said, AI is owned by the company. AI does not stand on its own, so it has no money or anything. It can't do this. So a lot of people look at AI as a human being. And because they dwell off of influence, they believe what it's saying. And that I think is a big danger, just like with cell phones and stuff, and when the World Health Organization actually designated those as an addiction to young kids.
They
I
are.
think this influencer behavior is like an addiction as well too. Somehow or another, we've got to get people back to understanding their value and knowing that they have thought patterns, and back to common sense when they realize that that doesn't make sense to me, so therefore I should question it and maybe look a little deeper. And we've got to get people to stop not wanting people to ask questions, not wanting people to talk about things.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think so, I also think that I'd love to get back to a place where people agree that, not all opinions are created equal. You and I can both have a whole lot of opinions about, like, how to approach a, cure for a medical, for some disease or something. And our opinions aren't as valuable as, somebody that has years and years of experience in, like, doing medical research and a MD and all these things. Like, we're just not, it's not the same. Just like your opinions relating to AI are going to be far more grounded in fact and than mine are, right? You've been doing this for a long time. You've been out there seeing projects, and I'm just talking to folks like you, right? And so, I would love to see that. I would also love to, also to your point about how phones are addictive, they're addictive by design, right? And when you look at how the havoc that social media specifically has wreaked on our society over the last 25 years, right? And understanding we are a relatively media literate society, right? And we have been. We've had newspapers out for a long time. We've had TV out for a long time. And over a longer period of time, like, it's obviously, amplified by social media, has really done a lot of harm. But then you look at what happened when Facebook rolled out into Myanmar in like 2016, 2017, essentially enabled an ethnic cleansing, and they've never ever said anything about that, and never will. But objectively looking at how all of these things are actually affecting society, I think is something that we really need to
Cognizant of.
be more cognizant of, be more aware of, and be more thoughtful about the approach to it, especially as you look at AI now and where we are. I kind of think of us now as like the dot-com 90s era of AI, right? And
Yeah.
a lot of the mistakes that we've made on the internet and the social media booms that have happened over the last 30 years, I would hope we could learn from them. I would
I
hope.
would too. I think they would show us a lot. As a matter of fact, that's why I selected storytelling and mythology in my book.
Absolutely.
That's one of the reasons, because we need to bring it in a sense, in a format that makes sense. And that's what mythology was for. It was telling stories, but it was also looking at natural phenomena. And it was together you could actually bring out a reasoning with that, like Icarus and Daedalus when they with the wings, and that had two stories within it. They could not escape, but they used the birds to create wings, which augmented their ability to fly. But then the father said, "Do not go too close to the sun or too close to the sea." But the sun did not heed that and wound up melting the wings and falling. So once again, you got an insight there that experience. Okay, you still need to hear it and listen to it. Because his demise was that he did not follow the experience of his father who knew more.
Absolutely. And the consequences associated with it, right? And I think one of the things that always fascinates me about like ancient, I would say ancient societies, but is the we in our modern world take that the next generation will kind of rebel against the former generation for granted, right? You look at what happened in, it happened in the 20s, it happened in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, definitely in the 60s and 70s, right? But that wasn't always the case, right? And I think the societal conditions that create a generation that has enough security to rebel is first fascinating, right? Enough security, enough wealth to rebel. But also, like, just because you want to rebel doesn't mean that the older generations didn't have a lot of wisdom, and it may not be represented in we can that's let's just say accessible to us, or in forms in like using words and phrases that people these days don't find offensive, without them realizing that the things that you and I are saying and doing right now, people will consider those offensive in 20 years for sure, because I know I did 20 years ago that's super offensive today, and I'm just glad that we didn't have smartphones around to capture it all. I find all of that super fascinating. Bit of a
No, I do too. I just think that we need to learn how to coexist, and we all need to learn how to collaborate. Like you said, we all have different strengths and weaknesses, and you don't even want to know if I want to call them weaknesses. And that, they're definitely not flaws, because flaws are contextual. You don't know what they are, but we need to be able to go back to that brainstorming, where you can be in a room and you want to bring all the ideas out. And you go at it until you have something, and there's no love loss, so to speak. Those were I experienced those, and they were absolutely great. We would be in there going at it, and then lunchtime would come. Okay, let's go have lunch, and we go sit and talk. Go back in the room, and everybody's going at it again. I've had people just going off, and hopefully the rules of it are you don't curse anybody out, but you can sit there and hit the table and say, "No, that makes no sense to me," and not take it personally.
Absolutely.
So I think that we need to realize, like you said, that there's more than one way to do something. And if the outcome is what you need, then pick one and go with it.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of not letting the desire of perfection get in the way, desire for perfection get in the way of good enough. Because in this business, good enough is what you get sometimes, right? Like, good enough to solve the problem, get the result we need, keep it moving, we can go back and re-examine it later. But I love your point about debate, because like I'm a firm believer that if two people are having a conversation and they agree on everything, one of them doesn't need to be there. Right? Like, what are we even doing? If we agree on everything, then like, well, this is just hot air, literally.
Because you want to change that dynamic. You want the best, and diversity brings that,
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. Diversity of viewpoints, of backgrounds, of opinions. I'm a firm believer in that diversity is one of America's superpowers. And one of the things that I worry about is when you start looking at some of the core, and you start thinking about, well, let me ask you, what do you think? Do you think some of the what do you think some of the core societal implications are when policymakers start losing trust in basic data provided by AI or by agencies or whatnot?
To be honest with you, I see them dancing around it right now. I don't even know. They don't have trust in anything, you know. And I know that zero trust is something that was big out there, but they are dancing around it. I think the policymakers are, they're checking off the box. I have a policy. They don't make certain that it's that is governed or you know that is followed. And that's why it takes, even though we sell all of these wins, it's taking them a long time to get through things. And then all of a sudden at the end, you realize that there was a lot of money spent, but it didn't meet the objective. But we've already claimed the win. So now we can move on and, you know, nobody knows the difference. So I don't know that the policymakers, I question all of that. I don't think our policies are, they don't carry, I don't think they carry any water at all, any weight in the water at all.
Unfortunate. How do you think folks can use AI to prop up and elevate different regimes? Whether it's just say radical governments. How as society, well, like as a society, how do you think we could defend against those?
Oh, you know what? It's a good question,
Giving
and
you easy
mull
ones
over it. Yeah, I'm gonna mull over
today.
it. AI, first and foremost, all of this was to improve us, to make it better, faster, cheaper. Okay, and we've since avoided that, so we aren't really following that level. I'm a strong believer again in systems and processes. And I think once you've defined those systems and processes, there are templates that you can follow. Templates are knowledge. So once you have that, you can move forward with it. But you still need to have those places where humans augment it. You know what? This didn't work well last time. Let's update it this time and let's try it this way. Okay. But we got that 80%, and it's the 20% that we can be reflective of getting to 90%. Okay. You know, I saw this thing recently about breast cancer, whereas at this point in time in the year, it was 5% of success rate on it. It is now at 91%.
It's
So, you
incredible.
know, that process has been improving. So I think the fact that we have voided the discipline of engineering systems, processes, and all of that, and so that eliminates, I think, our policies. And I'm not sure. You know what? I have no idea of how we're going to climb out of this. It scares me. This all really scares me.
And I think all over the world, I think you look at the rise of radicalism all over the world, right? And I mean, a breakdown of a post-World War II order that was established, largely held for 80 years, which is fantastic. But then, you look at kind of where we are is, the global instability has really increased over the last, call it 20 years. And it is going to be really interesting to see how we're going to move forward from
How
here.
we move forward and bring this back.
Mm-hmm.
I do think people are getting tired of it because it disrupts their peace in life, okay? And I do believe that most people want peace in life, but AI, the thing with AI right now is that we have delivered a message that AI will replace us. And there are a lot of people who actually believe that. And when you believe that, you are empowering the influencers to take it in that direction. It's almost like with nuclear. When they started out with nuclear, everybody was going for nuclear because that would be something to protect them in war, right? And then they eventually realized that it was something that would hurt and kill off everybody. So then what did they do? They decided no nuclear development anymore. So my thoughts again are, why would we want to develop something that would replace us? And so now that we've got people thinking that, and unless we can reverse that, it's gonna be difficult. But that's one of the things that I want people to realize in AI, that we control it. We're the ones that write it. Computers don't just wake up one day and say, "I know all of this." You know, even and if we're trying to emulate humans, especially with like AI, artificial intelligence, and all of that, that's why we're looking at neuroscience. Even with that, we know the evolution of life, and a baby doesn't come out automatically knowing everything. They even have a soft top in their head where it continues to develop once they get into the environment. So the same thing with AI, we got to start with those basics. And even like our critical thinking skills, those are part that we put into AI. So in order for AI to become a critical thinker, we have got to absorb, it has to absorb what we are doing, except for like maybe intuition. Now, intuition, it would never probably be able to capture that. But things like deductive and abductive and inductive reasoning, yeah, we'll be able to put that into the computer. And then, but we got to monitor it and make certain that it doesn't go astray.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that those are the things that we know that it can't replace us with? Because I know you advocate for like an assistant versus assistant augmenting model, as opposed to a replacement model, correct?
Yeah, well, it all depends. I look at automation and assistant and augmentation. I kind of lump them together. Automation is something that is it's almost like exact science and applied science, okay? Exact science, you know, like math, 2 plus 2 is 4. And those things are given. So that can be automated. That's why we have a calculator. Those types of things can be automated, and you know, they're constantly checked, validated, and everything, so they're fine. But then you have those things that augment where you need a human to eventually make the decision on it. Okay. So yeah, but AI within those realms, call it what it is. Okay. The typewriter. We automated the typewriter with the PC. Okay. We still have the same keyboard, but then we have digital in the background that allows us to do things. And then we begin to integrate it with other things. So that's automation. We didn't change it. Okay. We automated the ATM, automatic teller machine. That was to automate tellers. Okay. So what was that to do? To give checks, to accept it, to get money out, to do things. So that's what we automated there. That's AI as well. We keep calling it AI as a general topic, but we need to call it what it does. A GPS. GPS automated the map.
Absolutely.
But of course, we gotta keep with GPS, we got to stay on top of it because our paths are changing constantly. You know, you could go to sleep one night and wake up and you got a different roadmap the next day. So those are things that you have to think about. So yeah, but automation is one thing. It's when it's exact and you know what the results are going to be or what the outcome is going to be. Augmentation, you don't. You need assistance with it. It's almost like writing the paper, the research paper, okay? Now, I love the large language models for that because it has actually shortened my time to go do my sourcing. I can tell it what I want, where it's going, but see, I still put in the work of reading and checking and verifying and writing the paper behind it. Okay. So
Absolutely.
that has augmented me with my ability to do the research paper.
Yeah, no,
But
and that's where human in the loop comes in when you have augmented
you got it.
processes, right?
You got it. Yes.
Automation, you don't need a human. Like, I don't need a the literally the point of an ATM is to not have a human in the loop, although I'm
Right.
sure that a human is involved in reviewing that data at some point.
Absolutely.
And looking at that to make sure it's all logged properly and categorized properly, but you don't need, like, the point is to get the human out of the loop there and have them do other things, correct?
Other things that make the process more efficient and more effective.
Absolutely, 100%. And then, as you think about it, like the concept of a digital employee, right? Why do you need to be careful about framing it, and how should we frame it?
A digital employee?
Yeah, and you think about
Talking about
the
a robot?
yeah, that's I mean yeah, a robot. That's a robot. I mean, I'm thinking like a like maybe like an agent, right? Where that's doing a repetitive process and automating things, and is taking, say, a data entry job away, or is augmenting a data entry job, so you need less people to enter more data, things like that, right?
Yeah, but you know, even with that, like you're saying, it hasn't worked, and we're not recognizing that it hasn't worked. Let me ask you, how many times have you dealt with a robot on a customer service line?
Just as few times as possible.
Right. And how long does it take you to get to where you need to get?
I mean, as soon as I could, I just press zero and yell operator until I get somebody on the line, right?
And
Literally.
now they've taken away that effect of operator now, and they keep circling back in. So to me, it's not working because a lot of times they are reading off of scripts and scripts that someone has written. And sometimes you got a different question. If you don't ask the right question, you know? And then what they've done is they've outsourced it to a foreigner, and they're given a script, and you can't get past it. So I don't know that I think that we need to. I don't say that it won't work, and I'm not saying that it's not a good idea, but I think we need to look at how it's working now and improve it.
Why do you think it's not working though?
Because customer service.
Well, I mean, not just customer service. Like, I mean, that's one example. But why do you think that
Even
agents?
self-service. Self-service in I'll look at CVS, self-service, okay? You go look at CVS now, and they want you in most cases to check out. So they've eliminated a lot of people. They're short-staffed in there, and they want you to check yourself out. Well, the full service is going back and forth between the self-service, okay? So that's slowing up people, and then they have to watch it because they've gotten a lot of theft now because people will ring it up and walk right out the door without paying.
That's true. That's true. That absolutely will. And then and then they do things like locking up stuff instead of hiring more people, right?
Right. So everything is locked up and you got to wait for somebody to come open it. They don't have the people there. So I'm just saying that I'm not saying that it can't work, but we have not thought about all of the activities that actually surround that to make it work better.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. No, I appreciate that. And I am curious about some of the work you did in your doctorate around intangible values. How can organizations calculate like intangible value of say high performing employees or things that they cannot replace?
This is that's the good, very good question because a lot of times they did expert systems, and when you ask somebody to actually evaluate themselves, people are always going to evaluate themselves higher. That's just natural, okay? Some people won't, but the majority of people do. So experts, you have to figure out who the experts are. And here's the thing, and when you have somebody in your company, this is right back to the identification, okay? And having a profile within the company. You should know the projects they're working on. You should know, who they work with because relationships are important too. You might find that when you're looking at something that a person, and also it should tie into the performance or the evaluation system. You could have a reporting relationship where someone works with someone and they are a stellar employee and they're doing top-notch work, okay? You move that person to another project, they're reporting to somebody else, and all of a sudden they get the worst evaluation they've ever had. Someone, HR, needs to step in and say, let's talk about this because this is not th this just isn't right. This person should never have been received this type of evaluation when they've already received this type. Okay, now either the reporting person is not telling the truth, or the employee is they don't like the employee or something of that matter. But you need to get to the bottom of that, so to speak. Okay. So here's the thing. If you're doing intangible valuation, you tie those things together. What I did with my dissertation was I actually went out to CEOs and COOs and all of them, and I said, what do you need to know? What are the values that you need to know? And so they came back, or my surveys came back, and they winded up boiling down to eight areas that provide value within an organization. And those eight areas are like employees, partners, information. And by the way, information, there has been studies that have shown that a lot of people who work, that they spend 20% of their time looking for information they need to complete their task, and 99% of the time they don't find it,
Wow,
which is wasteful.
that's
Okay.
super wasteful.
Process, technology. And so those eight actually compose the value structure. Okay. Now you can actually tie those together. You can take an employee and you can relate them to technology that they know. Okay. And how do you know they have that? Because a lot of times with that technology, they have certifications or they have years of experience. Okay. You see how you're putting all of those things together? We need to define what are the attributes of an employee that tell us what their performance is. And this is when you bring in people who are economists and econometrics who help to identify that. So then I can identify who are my most highly performing employees and who are also my more profitable employees, because some employees develop relationships with customers. So if this employee has been working with this customer and has been successful, and the customer is a he's a repeat customer, they're profitable, they're constantly paying, and the relationship is based on that person, then you want to keep them around too. And
Absolutely.
potentially, you want to, if you get into knowledge, you want to talk to them and see how they're managing that so that you can have someone in succession to come in behind them in the event that they leave.
Absolutely.
So
100%.
it can be done, but it's a structure. Here's the thing. For financial, you have an entire accounting system that sets up all of those relationships, okay? Intangible, you have one thing, goodwill. Now, they do have the International Accounting Standards Board that does some of this and has broken it down, but it's not been adopted by the United States. But we need you need an intangible valuation system the same way you need this accounting tangible accounting system. And
Absolutely.
those attributes need to be set up there.
Now, are patents considered intangibles as well?
Yes.
Okay. How do you value them?
By the product. I mean, once you, by what it brings in.
Okay, but I mean, with the time limit on patents, right, and how they're put in place, is it like valued differently based on, or is there a different way to value the underlying intellectual property, instead of just the product?
Yeah, it probably would be, but you know what? I'd have to bring in an econometrics person or someone to answer
So I'm just asking questions, okay, Dr.
Yeah.
Anya. So ha with all of your years of experience in working as a professor, right, and teaching, with the, let's just say, rise of utilizing AI in assignments, how should the education system be thinking about changing, like, the homework structure, or how should professors and teachers be thinking about AI proofing assignments, or should they be, like, is it focusing on in-work class? Or like, I mean, how do you continue to teach when you can generate papers that demonstrate mastery, whether you have it or not?
Yeah, but the papers don't. You can tell it. But you know, we and again, I straddle between theory because that's what we're here for, and practice. And even in my book, I say I don't know how we got off the beaten path, because in order for us to have theory, we have to have practice, and in order for us to have practice, we have to have theory. Because in order for me to develop that framework, I had to go out to people who were practicing to get that information, okay? And then I establish it so you can use it, and then we keep this circle going, right? So the thing is, and let me see, I went with that and then I lost my train of thought on it for a second,
Oh no.
but bring me back to it.
Teaching is
Yes, teaching. I believe in Bloom's taxonomy. I think Bloom's taxonomy has been in existence for a while, and I think it's perfect. You got to first give people knowledge. They have to understand what it is they're dealing with, okay? And then you take them up the path of application and synthesis and that sort of thing. So I believe that even with the classes, I love things that do like immersion, where you kind of immerse people into the things, almost like even in the law school where they have the mock trials and stuff like that. So you give them that knowledge, you teach them how to apply it, and then you let them synthesize it themselves and keep moving. Okay, so you need to build a pedagogy that reflects that, okay? And I think, like, even in my class, when without the papers, because I didn't really want to do the papers because it's not malicious intent. These students are just trying to get good grades, okay? And so what I went with was Harvard has this case study system, and it's immersion, basically. What you do is simulations. So you put them in these simulations where they have to make decisions. And so I do like three of those. And, you know, they're done online and they have to have their own PC. So we have to have it and they go through, and some of them are in groups and some of them are individuals. And then we have discussions around them. And it really, they enjoy it. And when we have these discussions are really, they're lively because they're like, oh my God, I never thought about making this type of decision, or I never thought about this, or what apply. So I think we need to get back to the point where we're actually putting people into the positions where they have to make the thoughts and they have to apply what they're learning.
I completely agree with you. I think back on one of my favorite classes I ever took was a civics class that was taught. And you know, we there'd be like a little lecture about a specific topic area, right? And then it would be just what you said. It'd be all right, the professor would give you like, all right, so here's this thing, talk about it, right? What do you think we should do? And then you get a little bit more information, and how does that change things? And then a little bit more information, and there'd be conversation back and forth. Oh, excuse me, but I think that's it forces people to think and think about consequences of decisions, right?
And then I also give them, they have to do a one-page write-up of their thoughts. Give your thoughts so I can know what you're thinking and how you did it. And it's amazing what they produce.
Yeah, well, that's awesome because it's a one-page write-up as opposed to like a 20-page paper, which makes it easier and less prone to people cheating on it, I guess. Or I don't even know if I consider AI cheating. I think that it's.
Yeah, it's the way it's been presented to them. It's presented as a tool that will replace their work, and it shouldn't be presented that way. It should be presented as a tool that can augment, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's how I use it. I use it to augment the things I do and let me do. I do more things faster, and you know, the work product is almost as good or better or as good. And you know, again, I don't want good the desire for perfection to stand in the way of good enough.
Absolutely. And plus, we can't have it both ways. You know what? We're fearful that AI will replace us, but then when they give them something like that, they want it to write it for you. You can't have
Absolutely.
it write it for you to replace you and then be fearful that it's going to replace you.
Do you think that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy where if people talk about it replacing them enough, it could end up replacing them?
Not sure. Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
I only have one more question for you, Dr. Green. As we think about humans right now, and I think one of the major themes is that we need to do a better job of custodian, a better job being custodians of our data, and our ethics, right? As an individual listening to this podcast, what is, you know, what would, what's the, what are like the, you know, what's the best thing or the top couple things that people could do to, exemplify this in their lives?
And my thing is, I want them to look in the mirror and see how it could affect their life if they are not represented properly. And that might bring a light on, you know. Mine is, I want to, at one time I said, I want to be disruptive. And I'm like, no. And someone said, that's not. I said, I want to be an illuminator. Let's turn the light on bright so people can see what's going on. And sometimes you got to start with you, you know. And so when you sit back and, you know, as I've said, it doesn't replace us, it reflects us. So let's make certain that what's in that digital realm actually represents us. And then look at it sometimes and think, if something changes, what is the impact or the risk on my own life?
Love that. Thank you so much. Any points you'd like to make? Anything else I forgot to ask?
No,
I
I think
agree. Thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed it. I've been very thought-provoking. Thank you again. And everybody out there listening, thanks for listening to Robots and Red Tape, and I hope you're having a great day.